Barbarian.
And I'm on board as well.
Excellent. I'm Sean Vieira.
And I'm John Connolly.
And this is Andrew Stein.
And we, together, are Excollegiate.
Yeah, am I the only one getting garbling?
Well, considering the ever-expanding definition of hate crime, that's no surprise.
Sorry, you're breaking up.
The people of Iowa had one of their world-famous caucuses and just decided Japanese is where it's at.
You know, there's 18% of the population that lives here speaks Spanish, and you're just going to let them all jump in the water and eat by piranhas? No.
Of course, but just being a stickler for detail, I would probably enact an ordinance that did not require a business to have a piranha pool.
Shut up, John.
Wow.
All
right. Wow. Well, now we have synchronicity. Welcome to session number 3 of
Excollegiate.
Section 3, parentheses 4.
To actually survive, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're... it's actually the 4th, but only the 3rd one to survive, if we count the first one. But I don't know if we're counting the first one or not. So... But be that as it may, we have some interesting ground to cover today. And if you guys go to change.gov and go down to the bottom and click on their under the agenda, the first thing under the agenda is civil rights. But if you will, go to change.gov and then
I'm already there.
Alrighty. Yeah. Are you looking at the civil rights bit?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, the question, of course, is this what America really needs? Given the election of President Barack Obama, is one of the most serious issues in this country currently the problems that we have with civil rights?
Well, I don't think civil rights is exactly a problem. I think what is problem is civil responsibility.
Okay.
I think by and large, you know, there is still racism out there. You know, there's still people who will act in a racist way, but, you know, that's not exactly the same thing as, you know, being the forefront of the problems facing the country today. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't, you know, he says, okay, the problem, pay inequality, hate crimes on the rise. You know, first of all, pay inequality, that's reflected basically in a one-to-one representation of the size of the workforce.
Yeah.
And the percentages of who makes up the workforce. It's simple, you know, simple statistics is, you know, if you have twice as many men and women in the workforce, the chances are a man's going to get the promotion to get to the higher pay grade. Hate crimes on the rise. Well, considering the ever-expanding definition of hate crime, that's no surprise.
You know what's really funny? Scroll down a little bit further, and you will see his plan includes expand hate crime statutes.
Right.
Although rising further.
Yes.
Which will, by definition, classify more crimes as hate crimes, and by definition,
increase the problem that we
crimes.
Have.
It will increase what is listed above.
Yeah.
Number 3, efforts continue to suppress the vote.
That means
a recent study discovered numerous organized efforts to intimidate, mislead, and suppress minority voters.
Study by who?
That's the thing. Both sides tried to suppress the vote of the other side.
And it wasn't simply because they were a minority. It was because they were part of the other side, or they thought they were a portion of the other side.
I guess the goal here is to encourage people to vote so long as they'll vote for Obama. And use the power of the federal government to prevent people who would vote for Obama from voting for Obama.
Yes.
Maybe, but another thing to consider, too, recent studies discovered numerous organized efforts to intimidate, mislead, and suppress minority voters.
Right.
Republicans are minority voters at this point.
You know that's not what they mean.
I know that's not what they mean.
But it is something worthwhile to point out.
The thing is that why only pay attention to
race and sexual
trying
based
to suppress,
minority?
To suppress, people on a racial point. You should be trying to stop all voting fraud as well as all vote suppression.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And then disparities continue to plague criminal justice system. This is an interesting question.
Yeah.
African Americans and Hispanics are more than twice as likely as whites to be searched, arrested, or subdued with force when stopped by police. Disparities in drug sentencing laws, like the differential treatment of crack as opposed to powder cocaine, are unfair. However, something that a lot of people don't realize when they talk about how unfair the justice system is to minorities is that in a minority, you're more than twice as likely to not only to be searched, arrested, and subdued with force, but you're more than twice as likely to be picked up more than once for various crimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay,
yeah,
so are you
maybe... You need to... Well, I'm basically saying that not all of it, but there is a certain amount of factor where you need to let the criminal justice system take its course because minorities break the law more often than not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
But you have situations where obeying laws is considered too white, and you know, going to school or getting good grades, it's considered white. It's considered sellout. There's a really interesting comic strip called Boondocks.
Okay.
And the main character's younger brother is just two black kids who are living with their grandfather in the middle of the boondocks, surrounded by white people in suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
The younger brother is always upset whenever he gets above a C on his report card because he thinks it's going to hurt his street cred.
I see.
You know, this... It's a problem. There's a gigantic there's a cultural disconnect with certain minority communities. Not so much with Hispanics, but with African Americans, definitely. There's the problem that everyone says is, look, they're living in the ghettos. You know, they have awful job opportunities. They're always being picked up by the police. But at the same time, these are people who repeat offenses, who are constantly going back to crime. And that's definitely something that needs to be addressed, but at the same time, they don't want to stop that. They don't want to leave that life because that's part of their culture. That's part of being black to them. That's actually part of the reason why Barack Obama was criticized heavily early in his campaign for not being black enough.
Right.
There's the same reason why Condoleezza Rice is considered not black enough.
Right.
So, what you're saying... No, go ahead.
I mean, Condoleezza Rice basically said, you know, look, people need to stop going to crime and try to better themselves through working hard. You know, you're going to be a lot better off if you can hold down a job, a 9-to-5 job, 5 days a week. Rather than being in and out of jobs or just working part-time. I don't know. There are some people who basically say that the system itself keeps blacks from being able to hold down a 9-to-5 job. I don't believe that. I believe there are enough opportunities out there that they can get hired, they can survive, and they can get a better life if they actually did not see things in terms of racial war. Or you know, see things in terms of an economic war.
So that's just basically the chief problem, is that what keeps certain groups down is this sense of outsiderness, and this sense of outsiderness
is enhanced by programs
which are intended to get them out.
Mm-hmm. Or programs which say you are an outsider, and therefore we're going to give you particular kinds of treatment. At a certain point, this whole system starts to feed the problem rather than removing it. The question is, have we gotten to that point in our current day and age, you know, where the system is ceasing to keep people from being outsiders and is starting to actually keep people outsiders rather than drawing them into the fullness of
the truth be told, I do not believe that that the system is at fault.
Okay.
You know, people keep talking, oh, the system's at fault. We need to change the system. I mean, that's definitely what Obama's basically saying.
The system is people.
You know, the system itself is just society. It's mm-hmm. just people doing their thing.
Yeah.
And what Barack Obama is a proponent of is everyone in the world should stop doing their thing, should stop, you know, having these contracts, stop hiring on these bases, so that way we can make room for an African-American ghetto culture that has no respect for the laws and customs of the country, that really wants to remain separate from society while at the same time leeching off of it.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay. So, if I was to put this another way, what you're saying basically that there's a certain subculture among the African-American population and among others that basically is looking to leech off of the rest of society. And
I don't know if it's, I would just put it that way. That makes it sound like they're intentionally looking at society and saying, yes, we need to take advantage of that. But I think a large amount of it ends up leeching off of the rest of society just because that's its default option. It's easier that way. You can be lazy that way. You know, you get, you know, the vast amount of people who are getting the welfare paycheck aren't really looking to get to work. It's not like the economy is that bad that people just cannot get a job no matter where they go. A lot of times it's just easier. A lot of times you can just be lazy, and that will that will be a problem. You know, but at the same time, you know, I do think there's some good things on this page. You know, end racial profiling. You know, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, people should not. You shouldn't be more likely to end up in a lineup just because you're Hispanic, unless, you know, some Hispanic has committed the crime.
Right.
You know, you shouldn't have to basically separate people out into those different little canisters and then say, this is the crime canister, this is not. But at the same time, you always need to keep in mind that a lot of people are separating themselves off into that canister, and then it ends up being ridden with crime. Hmm. That gets the, you know, it gets a few who aren't offenders to be, you know, stopped and searched that much more often. It's, you know, it's a problem. It's a problem of 98% of people making the other 2% look bad.
Wow.
Although I would
eliminate sentencing disparities. I don't know about the crack and powder cocaine thing. Should be eliminated.
It has nothing to do with black and white. It has to do with rich and poor. Powdered cocaine is much more expensive than crack, or it used to be anyway. And it's associated with rich people, whereas crack is associated with poor people.
Yeah. I can see that too. Why should sentencing be different for crack cocaine as powder based?
Well,
I mean, is there any fundamental difference in the drug?
Well, there is a fundamental difference in the way that in the way the drug is marketed. Whereas powder cocaine is targeted at the rich and wealthy, Hollywood types, crack cocaine on the streets of Chicago and elsewhere are the lifeblood of the various large gangs. So some of which are black, some of which aren't, which...
Mm-hmm. Well, some of which are Hispanic, yeah.
Which are one of the huge reasons why certain neighborhoods and certain inner city urban areas are kept downtrodden.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, then. I mean, I wouldn't reduce the sentence for crack cocaine. I'd just up the sentence for powder-based.
Well, maybe, yeah, it works.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd say, yeah, you know, there shouldn't be any difference because of the circumstantial elements of the drug. You know, if the law is against possessing the drug, there shouldn't be any disparity in sentencing simply based on how the drug was processed. Regardless of what circumstances surround that. If you want to charge someone with a gang-related crime, then you charge them with that, and you try them on that, and you sentence them on that. You don't try to sneak in a backdoor sentencing on gang activity by doing so in a drug sentence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't do that. And so it's a jurisprudence aspect. It's about good sentencing and good judgment. It's not about racism.
Yeah. That is true. It's very, very true. So in the end, though, what we're sort of looking at here problematically is we have someone who's attempting to put together a system to eliminate a problem which isn't the kind of systematic problem that he seems to imagine it could be.
Well, and there you end with every single problem that goes along with widespread and pervasive federal government, is that a whole lot of the problems in our country today are cultural problems. And it's just something that government is not equipped to address. And because government is not equipped to address them, it's always going to look at the problem, misassess the problem, and then put in the wrong remedy for the assessment that they got.
Yeah. That's true. Or then, if they put in the right one, to continue on it for a very long period of time and to develop something of a behemoth, which can't change course very quickly because of the size and scope of the thing and because of the necessity of oversight and very close oversight, makes it difficult to turn this thing around. So, in the end, what we're probably looking at is a good deal of money being put into programs for the sake of increasing the number of persons performing X or Y kinds of jobs or being put in these positions irregardless of the qualities of these people.
Regardless.
Or irrespective.
Irrespective, yeah. Okay.
Grammar Nazi says.
Indeed. So.
I have three complaints. That's one of them.
Okay.
There we go.
What are the other two?
I'll tell you someday.
Okay.
So. What sort of trouble are we looking at if these sorts of policies are put into place?
Well, again, I'm looking at this. I don't see very much that he can do policy-wise that is going to end these problems that he lays out. You know, we pointed out before, hate crimes on the rise. So you expand hate crime statutes, which by definition is going to make the statistic hate crimes rise.
even if you're measuring from an objective standard as to the number of people committing racially motivated crimes, this is not going to substantially reduce the number of people making racially motivated crimes.
This is true.
And deceptive voting practices. Obama says that he's going to sign into law his legislation, so he'll sign into law the legislation he sponsored, that establishes harsh penalties for those who have engaged in voter fraud, and provides voters who have been misinformed with accurate and full information so they can vote. All right, that basically means that he's going to spend probably the amount of leftover money he's got from his campaign on commercials every voting cycle, federal money for commercials every voting cycle, to make sure that people know they can vote Democrat. Further, you know, he's just going to increase penalties for voting fraud and for, you know, deceptive voting practices, which is fine, but that's not where the problem is. When it comes to voting problems, the problem isn't in sentencing people harshly. It's in actually catching them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's a problem that we've got. We had several instances of voter intimidation here in Philadelphia, and it's a perennial problem. Every election cycle, there will be two lines of union bosses who will just kind of stand outside the voting place as the union workers go in to vote. They don't say anything. They don't stop you, but you know that they're there, and they're basically giving you the message, you got to vote the way we tell you. The law needs to be probably laid out a little bit better. I would like to see absolutely no variant of electioneering done within 50 yards of the entrance to the voting place. That's what I would love to see. And to basically, you know, bring the police out to the voting places, and anyone who violates that, throw them in jail. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to have a harsh penalty for that then.
If you caught them, put it in.
That doesn't matter to me whether the unions complain. I mean, that's all unions have done for the past 150 years.
Well, that's the thing is, they control the elections.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who is able to send the police out there to stop the unions from controlling the elections are subject to the unions, or subjected to the unions doing
that. Not exactly. You see, unions control elections. Unions get Democrats elected. So
you do.
Yeah. You know, I just don't like the idea of this sort of thug mentality where you have these rogue Democrats, whether they're for the unions or not, they're not part of the Democratic Party, but you have rogue Democrats running around trying to influence people at the polls, and you have rogue Republicans running around and doing the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Down by you guys in Virginia, some idiot was running around putting up signs with the seal of Virginia on it in Spanish telling people that the government had unprecedented voter turnout this year, and because of that they had two elections, one on November 4th for Republicans and one on November 5th for Democrats.
Yeah, I heard about that. Yep. They sent mail around too.
Now, that sort of thing happens, and you know, immediately Democrats jump on it and say, look, this is just another instance of Republicans trying to influence the vote.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I mean, no one's got their nose clean in this, and I would dearly love to see a crackdown when it comes to this sort of thing, because you're not just talking about fraud. You're talking about inhibiting the way the government is supposed to work.
Yeah. No, it's serious, serious problem, and serious kind of a crime, inhibiting the free activities of election in a republic or a democracy.
That sort of thing, in theory, should be part of the way down the road to treason. It should be. No, it really should.
I'm agreeing with you.
You're working to subvert the will of the people, which is the formation for your government. You're trying to cut off your government at its roots.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is a serious problem, but definitely one to be.
And you know, I don't like Barack Obama. I did not want him to become our 44th president. But golly, you know, the voters voted for it. You got to put up with it now, or move to a different country.
Yeah,
because this is the way we choose our leaders here, and you can't get in the way of that.
No, this is true.
Whether you are the AFL-CIO or mm-hmm. whether you are some random nut running around trying to trick Hispanics in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, exactly. So, hi. So, but given that, at the same time, you're not guaranteed to have. Well, you're not guaranteed to have anything great come out of the will of the people. If as long as you're going to maintain this country as this country, you have to enable those who can to vote. So that makes for a very interesting, troubling set of circumstances where we have this.
Well, and that's another thing, too. You know, if it were me, I wouldn't leave voter registration in the hands of the parties.
Where would you set
just,
it?
I just wouldn't, because that influences how people register, and when that also does, in the end, influence how people vote some way. Of course, I mean, for me, I would love to see the whole party system just repealed. All political parties are hereby made, you know, illegal.
Right.
There shall be no political parties.
Maybe not that. Simply because of the nature of human beings.
Because that's not going to happen, the next best thing is a parliamentarian system where you basically say no individual political candidates need apply. Mm-hmm. You cast your vote for your party and then let your party take care of everything. Because at that point, that forces people to go find a party they actually agree with.
Another possibility, although I do say, I have to say there are certain things about that I do like. There are a very large number of laws in this country which make it very difficult for any small political organization to operate freely. There are certain laws that grant parties that basically match the description of the Democrat and the Republican Party. They make it very easy for them to do things like put up people to run for an office or to distribute political advertisements and things like that. Basically, they give preferential status to what they call major parties, which, for lack of better words, is the Republican and Democratic parties. Any other party that wants to go out and do things and actively make a mark in the political arena has to first beat down these particular laws. It has to acquire X number of signatures to put a candidate, you know, up for running. It has to...
Right.
It has to abide by more stringent laws or pay a more stringent percentage for political activity. And then, of course, you have McCain's laws that were supposedly going to reform. Yeah, the McCain-Feingold laws.
I don't think it was Feingold. Maybe it was Lieberman. But
you know, it was Feingold. It was McCain-Feingold.
Okay. But, yeah, you know, that's the thing, too, is in Texas this year, both the Republicans and the Democrats filed past deadline to put John McCain and Barack Obama on the ticket. And
in several states, actually.
Well, Bob Barr actually sued them to get them off the ticket in Texas, where he had a chance of carrying the state.
Yeah.
And after a couple weeks of hearings and everything, the judge handed down the ruling that the Democratic and Republican candidates were to remain on the ticket with absolutely no juridical
reasoning. Yeah.
There's no reason given. They said basically the logic was, yes, they broke the law. Yes, we know they did it. And yes, they can continue to do it. Because there's nothing they can do that we're going to impugn them for. We're not going to remove them for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, at which
because
point
I know probably what the thought process is. Well, we wouldn't have any problem taking Obama off the ticket, being Texas.
Mm-hmm,
but if
right.
you give preferential treatment to the Republicans, you have to at least give that choice to all the Democrat voters out there. And so we're just going to leave people and not disenfranchise the vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As opposed to doing what he should have done, which is remove them both failing to file in time.
To fail to listen to their own rules. And that's the thing, all these rules that were set up, they're set up by Democrats and Republicans to keep third parties out of the arena.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now they can basically just walk all over the rules, because these are rules they can easily meet.
Yeah.
And they're just ignoring them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, possible solution to this particular problem, impeach the judge. Yeah, it's as simple as that. Because you'll have a better chance of impeaching him than you will of completely destroying the Republican and Democratic parties just, you know, at a whim.
Or of making them stick to any of their rules during an
election. Yes, that's, you know, the more important point. You're very good there, Andrew.
But if we do kick out an enabling judge,
mm-hmm.
next time we have to stick it to the Republicans and Democrats during the election, we'll have a stronger standing.
One would hope so. Anyway, at least you make the point clear. You take on those who break the law that you can get your hands on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not advocating.
I don't know if we would
actually
have a stronger standing in the next election, though, Andrew, because. That depends greatly on who's appointing the next judge to replace him, doesn't it?
This is true.
But the thing is, the next judge remembers the last judge. What happened to the last judge?
Sort of. You see, I wouldn't even know the first thing about the process to impeach a judge. I know a lot about the process to impeach a president.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows that.
You know, and that's the thing is, if impeaching a judge works the same way as impeaching a president, that the representatives,
mm-hmm.
the representative government needs to do so,
yeah.
there's a vested interest in both the part of both Republicans and Democrats not to impeach this judge.
Aye. But it's easier to bring pressure to bear on senators from your state, you know, or in this case, possibly the representative, whatever the representative body of Texas is. to have this man impeached than it is to bring pressure on the senator in Washington, you know,
yeah.
or even your representative in Washington who's there on a shorter term.
Yeah.
The most influence you can have is at the local level. All right. That's the place where you can really make the change. When you can make change there, those people then are enabled to make change at the next level. And more readily able to do so. So if you get enough people making change at a local level, then you have a chance to enable people to, these people at your local level who you have talked to make change at the state level. And then from there, you have a chance to influence the making of policy on a national level. So.
In theory. Yeah.
Yes, in theory, it's a very long, drawn-out struggle. But all of this time, most of the political parties that I know of have tried for major change. They've tried to get into the political arena in the presidential elections and maybe in senatorial elections. But you don't really see a whole lot of attempts to get in as... to get into state governments, to get into just even into the U.S. House of Representatives, to get into local governments. That, I think, would be a far more efficient way of doing things.
The Libertarian Party is big at that. They actually try to get in local elections.
Interesting.
They're particularly strong in places like New Hampshire.
The Constitution Party runs consistently for like state senate and state representative seats as well. They're always edged out though. They never seem to get very much traction, and I really do question how these campaigns are being run. You know, I don't see them as making a deep pocketed concerted effort to. Unhorse whoever else is there simply because they don't want to. No one thinks they can do it, and until they think they can do it, they're not going to put in the money to do it. It's kind of catch-22.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to think they can do it until they succeed at least once or twice. And therein lies the problem that's ever circling about. So we're going to have battling back and forth for the soul of a nation on two sides of the same coin.
doesn't work for forever. But what we're looking at right now is that is the battle we're facing. So given that, then, and given this particular constituency for the next 2 years anyway, which would be a more efficient method of attack? To campaign at the local level for seats in various places to attempt to advert the worst of the problems that may come down from a democratically controlled federal government, or to attempt to inject some new blood into the Republican Party so that in 2 years you can add to the balance.
Well, and that's the thing right now. On the one hand, a lot of political experts are saying that the Republican Party is becoming a more regional party than a national one. And that really, we only have one national federal party now.
Oh, my.
And that's true. What we're looking at here is maybe, and possibly, the death spin of the Republican Party. Now, it can be resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, do we want to resurrect it? Because, you know, the Republican Party's got a lot of baggage. This is exactly the point in time where if the Republican Party doesn't get its act together, it's going to alienate its conservative base, and the conservative base could very easily be pushed over into a third party.
Mm-hmm.
And that would fracture things for a little while, but after a while, you would you'd be able to start weaning voters away from Democratic side and have a viable second party again. Mm-hmm. Of course, no Republican wants to see that, and they hate third party proponents even more, I think, than they hate Democrats, simply because
the Democrats are the loyal opposition.
The third party system, the third party believers. Are much more scary to a diehard Republican than they are to a diehard Democrat.
Well, because the third-party individuals are coming, being drawn far more from the Republican side of things than the Democratic side. And so it's a far more direct threat to a Republican to lose 5,000 voters to a third-party scheme because he's never getting those back, as opposed to losing 5,000 voters to the Democrats, who we might have back tomorrow.
Right.
Or he might have some other 5,000.
So here's the deal. I think that if the Republican machine is ever going to run again, it needs to be radically rethought. It needs to return to its reform movement roots, or at least its 20th century reform movement roots.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to get away from this, large government nationalistic bent. And it needs to really realign itself from local and start rebuilding its ties with grassroots rural communities and spread from there. Right now, this whole trying to remake yourself as a moderate thing is just not working. It's just not. You can't out-Democrat a Democrat.
This is true.
And, I think that that's really going to have to happen in a lot of the movements that have aligned themselves with the Republican Party as well. I think the pro-life movement needs to, needs to stop its obsession, its monomania with Roe v. Wade. Yes, it needs to be overturned. Yes, good laws need to be made. But that shouldn't be the primary and focus and sole end of the movement. But so many people act like it is.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not working on the ground and trying to enact a cultural metanoia.
Aye.
Then there is...
There's no hope for it.
There's nothing there. Well, there's nothing there. And because I think they have not been struggling for that, that metanoia, that change of heart in the community and in the culture, they're losing. I think that they have, because if they really were on the ground, and they really were looking at this in terms of human beings, mm-hmm. and not in terms of the law,
yeah,
we would not have had such dramatic compromise when it comes to the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would not have the party basically trying to ignore the comments about Terri Schiavo. We would not have had the NRL trying to ignore the comments about Terri Schiavo from Fred mm-hmm. Thompson so they could choose him. We wouldn't have the best chance of success clause inserted, because that's not where it's at. You know, the movement can't compromise its values simply to have a shot at overturning Roe v. Wade, because Roe v. Wade won't solve the problem, because it's a deeper cultural problem.
Yeah.
There's a culture of death.
It's law becomes ex populo, not mm-hmm. Vice versa.
Yeah.
You change the law, you're not going to change the problem.
Mm-hmm. If you change
people, you will solve the problem even without the law.
You will change the law.
You will change the law, but you will change the problem even more fundamentally.
Right. Yeah. The classical libertarian argument is that, you know, you don't need laws to make people good. You make people good, and then you don't need the laws.
Yeah, that's true. Laws are an aid to keeping people, or leading the young to good, and keeping those who would not be good from harming the rest.
I don't know how many young people are influenced by the law, but...
Well, no, formed by, to a certain extent. And not just young in a physical age way, but still. You know, it's...
what we're talking about here does bring us back to civil rights and Obama.
All right. Take it away.
Dr. Elvita King has said that abortion is not... Oh, no, I don't think it was her. I think it was Alan Keyes. Alan Keyes said,
mm-hmm.
Abortion is not... it's not a civic issue. And it's not a, you know, so much a religious issue as it's a civil rights issue. And the right to life,
mm-hmm.
and about, you know, this discrimination against the unborn. Will laws prevent a certain measure of that? Of course, yeah. But the goal is not to prevent a certain measure of it. It's to make a change deep in the culture, a change for the good, to the good, to a specific end. And in so doing, you know, we won't ever be able to effect complete and total conversion, but do what we can to help that. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you need a well-rounded outlook. Obama has some good ideas and some stupid ones on this page as to how to fight, you know, racial inequality. But again, all those ideas are just legislative, and he's talking like he could make the problems that underpin the society go away. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can, but not through top-down force.
Exactly. You cannot make the problem go away just through legislation. You can legislate until you're blue in the face. If people don't want to listen to you, they're not going to listen to the laws.
Yeah.
If people have no sense of good and bad, if people have no sense of right and wrong, if someone
is always willing to choose a white man over a black man in spite of the black man's skill, then no amount of forcing others who have less strength to choose black men over white men in spite of the white man's skill is going to help anything. In fact, it's going to injure.
Yeah. And You know, and this is the problem, is that, you know, we're a society without unified moral formation. And because we have no unified moral formation, we don't have a unified set of values.
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of a set of values creates this huge roadblock to actually solving some of the problems that beset our society. Because there are a good number of people out there who actually will tell you that they don't see those problems as problems. They just see them as either the way things are or as my morality versus your morality.
Mm-hmm. That's. I think you've laid your finger on the key right there, is the whole problem of the emotivist, as Alistair MacIntyre calls it, or as others call it, the reign of the relativist in the modern day and age, does pose probably the deepest of all problems, is where you can't make a universal statement.
Mm-hmm.
Living in a pluralized society, the strongest man makes a statement that he determines everyone else is going to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's been sort of the problem in the United States for a while.
And that's the thing, is that you look at, okay, let's look at George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
A good number of Democrats came out after he was elected and said, he's not my president. you know, he could be your president, but he's not mine. And now you look at Barack Obama, there are going to be tons of blacks who see him as their president.
Yeah.
But I can guarantee you there's a couple Klansmen in the Deep South who are going to say, oh, he's not my president.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, again, that's in the entire subjective problem, is the entire relativistic problem.
I know, there are a couple that will.
I mean, but there are a couple that will. But I mean, it's...
I mean, the Nazis love him.
Yeah.
That's a complete other story, which we should save for maybe next time when we have Ryan on the show. Drop that bomb on him. did you know?
Yeah.
But
I'm just saying is that there's nothing stopping people from looking at Barack Obama's laws that he lays down. And basically saying, well, those laws aren't compatible with my worldview, so I don't have to listen to them.
Yeah.
And, of course, I mean, they'll have to deal with ramifications if they're caught. But you cannot actively and equally enforce law on the entire culture, unless if you take away their freedom. It can't be done. You cannot have a society that both has freedom and enforcing laws that no one wants to follow and that don't meet with people's views.
Yeah. Then you wind up doing injury.
Laws can be good. Laws are usually good, provided they follow the formula for good laws. But you can't just make laws and just hope that people will listen, because either the laws are going to be overridden, or you're going to need to install the SS to make sure that they get listened to. And so you either have to give up your free society, or... change the society before you worry about changing the laws.
I would say you can't quite have that dichotomy. I apologize.
No, Obama's very big on talking about how you can't change the players. You just got to change the game.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that actually not meaning very much...
Oh, it means quite a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, in terms of actual...
In terms of
ramifications, policy. Yeah, it does not mean very much. But aside from that, it's quite obvious that he and quite a few Democrats out there see the problem as a legislative one. All the problems of this... society is merely legislative ones. If we change the policies correctly, if we did enough to change laws, if we just got people more education or more health care or, you know, more racial equality, then
or more money,
better, then things would be perfect. mm-hmm. know, and that's, well, ultimately, that's what the form it takes. But the, idealistically, in abstract, what they think is, if we just did X, everything would be perfect. What a wonderful world we would have. And ultimately, that's not correct, because no matter how many protests you have, no matter how many marches, whether you're marching for life or marching for AIDS, no matter how much money you throw at a problem, no matter how much education you overflow a society with, that will not actually make the better society. And you need to have in mind that you will never have a perfect society. But in trying to make the lives of the populace better, it is just as necessary, if not more so, to change the hearts and minds of the people than it is to change the laws of the land.
Aye. No, it's very true. But if you can get that, you can get that fire burning in people, get it, it will reach out and make great changes. Because in the end, the problem isn't so much, touched on a couple of good points there, I think, though, in disparaging education, perhaps a little too broad, because in the end, the operation of individual people is also going to be very much a process of educating, not just necessarily in the classroom, but through their lives, drawing people out and teaching.
I don't mean true education when I say that. I mean the policy education, the federal education, the
to put money into something and put people in a room and throw facts at them is not the same thing as educating them. But I think we need to make that distinction, because it's important to not lose the fact that the words are good. All right, the words are very good, and if you just disparage it with the words that they want to use, then you're going to lose something very essential when you come back to try and talk about your solutions.
Right.
Okay. So, it's just a point to throw out there. We always need to seldom affirm, more seldom deny, but always distinguish. You know. So, that's just a thought there. So I think there we could have something.
Looking around at the rest of this website now, it's very interesting.
Oh yes, I'm currently looking at service. His plan for service.
Oh, I'm looking at immigration.
Oh my!
And,
all right.
And actually, Barack Obama has adopted a policy stance from John McCain. I don't know if you actually saw this speech.
No.
But there was a speech John McCain gave sometime during the election season. He was talking about immigration, and he said, why don't we just allow immigrants who don't have criminal records to come out, pay a fine, learn English, and then apply to become citizens here in the United States? That's what he said. It's like a direct quote from him.
All right.
Here is a direct quote from the president-elect change.gov website. Obama and Biden support a system that allows undocumented immigrants who are in good standing,
not criminals,
to pay a fine, learn English, and go to the back of the line for the opportunity to become citizens.
More proof
like
that you were more proof that you were electing one side or the other of the same freaking coin. But
yes, this would like in immigration. Barack Obama's website talks about securing borders, improving the immigration system to have a larger load, removing incentives to enter. This is all stuff from McCain.
Yep.
It's like both of them had an absolutely identical immigration platform.
Aye. No, they were similar in very, very many ways. This, you know, it does. It poses its own interesting problems, but you know, basically what you're looking at here is a solution that runs similar to the way that every other semi-sensible plan that's been posited so far has run, you know? attempt to ship the criminals back to Mexico, and then try and figure out what to do with all of these other people who you're going to encounter, who are just...
Camps.
What?
We should put them in camps where they learn English.
Okay.
Yeah, have them work and contribute to the economy while they're there.
Okay. I am going to go off on a bit of a rant, if I may. Just to...
You're breaking up, John.
I'm sorry.
No, sorry. But to go off on this rant, are you sorry? Tell me if I'm wrong here. But it seems to me that there is a rather foolish aspect of the those who want to talk about immigration who say that people who come to this country have to learn English. I say, if you want to be a citizen, yes, you should have to learn the common tongue of the people. Because you have to be able to read the nation's laws, to interpret its statutes, and to understand what those who are running for office are saying, so that you can make an informed decision, so that you can act as a citizen should. But to say that someone who is going to live in this country, short-term or long-term, should have to learn English? This is something I've never understood.
Well, okay. See, short term, no, I don't think they would have to learn English. But long term, yes, of course. Because if you don't learn English,
mm-hmm.
If you don't require people living here to learn English,
mm-hmm.
that ultimately leads to requiring everyone else to learn their language so that they can communicate, they can actually get what they need. So either you're going to learn the language needed to survive, or everyone else is going to have to learn enough of your language to allow you to survive. And that puts an undue burden on society.
You'll end up with an even worse problem, which is ghettos. Subsections of regions of the country or the state or the locality where people only speak Spanish. And people who only speak Spanish can't get out of those ghettos and get mm-hmm. into the regular area, and it creates a divide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yeah. very hurtful for the people who don't speak English.
No, that does happen as well. You end up with yet another cultural disconnect. Not to say that all cultures must be one and that we have to have the master race or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
but it creates its own society inside society, there's no way that ordinary authorities can go in and help solve the problems there. So either police are considered by the entire community to be the bad guys, and so therefore police enforcement is nil, or cases of, like, domestic abuse inside these centers go completely and totally unreported because they cannot communicate with the police unless the police speak Spanish. You know, these things happen. So basically what it turned into is either widespread minority appeasement based on just the fluctuation of the populace, which means that you end up with something like Miami where just certain sections of Miami, all the television and all of the radio is in Spanish, just because that's just what people speak and they don't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
Or you basically say, no, look, this is our country, this is the official language, we conduct our business in this language, and it's unreasonable of you
mm-hmm.
to require of us
mm-hmm.
to speak something else because it's not our language.
Yeah, no, see, this I can understand. I can understand someone saying, who's living by this ghetto, no, I'm not going to put my signs up in Spanish, you know, or I'm not going to put my signs up in French, I'm not going to put my signs up in Italian, I'm not going to put my signs up in Gaelic. All right?
Mm-hmm.
If you Poles can't speak the language that I'm selling my wares in, then too bad. Go buy from the Polish shopkeeper down the street. All right? Go buy from the German. All right? But there seems to be this understanding. Here's where I have the problem, that it somehow then becomes government's responsibility to make a law that requires those who are staying in this country for the long term to learn English.
Not at all.
Yeah, no, see, as opposed to the common sense thing, which is like, if you can't speak it, you're going to spend time with your own people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you simply allow for the pressures of population, there's going to be this intermingling, which is going to teach the language.
I don't think that you can create a law, a positive law, saying everyone must speak English.
Yeah.
Because then if you hear another language out in the street, you have a duty to go turn them in. that's not what people are meaning. What they're meaning is repeal of laws and ordinances that require businesses to put up a certain percentage of their signs in Spanish.
All right.
That require laws and businesses to adapt to minority needs that are unreasonable. Because this is not a Spanish-speaking country. If the government wants to go and say, our official language is Spanish, you know, I won't like it, but I'll go learn Spanish. I would expect every single shopkeeper, every single, you know, government agency to speak to me in Spanish, to advertise in Spanish. I would want that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not about, you know, some Anglophile idea. I mean, you guys both know I'm not an Anglophile.
not even an Anglo.
I'm not even an Anglo. You know, and this is coming from someone who's half Hispanic. You know, I do not think that businesses should be required to operate in Spanish simply to appease a minority. And I do think that those businesses that cater to minorities in Spanish only, television stations, radio stations, literature, are perpetuating a problem and enabling people to not learn English. You know, it's the same problem you get with, you know, all kinds of different behavior. How much do you want to encourage it? I mean, at the same time, you don't want to make people uncomfortable who are new to the country.
Yeah. No, see, this is the thing.
So
it's
I could see having certain programs in Spanish, things like that. But whole stations in perpetuity, we're just going to have it in Spanish from here on out. This is just the Spanish-speaking region.
No. Well, you see, here's the thing. On the one hand, you make a good point where you say you don't need... Sorry, you're breaking up.
Yeah,
oh, good. Okay. On the one hand, obviously, it's harmful to be requiring people to cater to this particular minority. To say that, all right, here we have, Jose, and you have to put up a certain number of signs that Jose can read. These are not essential signs like, you know, mind the piranhas, that, you know, there's 18% of the population that lives here speaks Spanish, and you're just going to let them all jump in the water and be eaten by piranhas? No. You put up signs that are understandable by as many people as possible. You know, preferably pictorial signs that don't require you to understand the language, require you to understand the idea that stick figure is a human being and then he's being consumed by something.
Being eaten by fish in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, don't swim here kind of thing.
Of course, just being a stickler for detail, I would probably enact an ordinance that did not require a business to have a piranha pool.
Got rid of the piranha pool.
That's something. But at the same time, I think you also have you have the same kind of problem where you want to say also, if someone wants to simply cater to the Spanish-speaking population, they should then not be able to do so. If they want to go ahead... Oh, okay.
I would not like them to do that. They have freedom to do that. But I do think that they're doing that is enabling people to not learn English. It's encouraging people to not learn English. They're legal. It is their right and their freedom to only have radio... If you own a radio station, you want to broadcast in Spanish only. I don't care if you do that in, you know, Texas and Southwest Texas, or if you do that in, you know, Bangor, Maine, you've got the right to do that. I don't think you should. I think that that's a bad idea. But you have the legal right to do that. You know, don't get me wrong. But I am saying that the government should not be passing laws that make foreign language requirements upon businesses and upon individuals who own properties. Because that's unreasonable. It's basically saying, look, you're required to operate in a language that is not the language of the land.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely astounding. You know, if people want to do it, they'll do it. And you look at the smaller European countries, such as Switzerland, they don't have, like, language requirement out there. They basically, you use the languages that people are going to use. But when it comes down to it, you know, you use the official language of the land. If, you know, like,
Switzerland.
Well, in Switzerland, they do have three.
It depends on the canton. It depends on the canton you're living in. Each canton has a language in which it conducts business, in which it conducts governmental affairs.
Right.
When you get to their federal government, I believe they conduct it in one language, but I believe they also provide for those who can't read that particular language.
But in a country where you recognize multiple languages as the language of the land, then I can see putting out requirements saying, okay, look, all bathrooms in the Senate building should have both French and German labels, just because we don't want the French.
We don't want
the
German matron
going into
wandering
the German women's. Yeah, you know, we don't want that happening. You know,
so bad blood all around.
Say, you know, this is what we're doing. But here in this country, you know, people speak English, and because of that, you should not be creating a burden upon property owners to conform to another country's standard in this country. So from a legal perspective, I would basically repeal all laws for language standards of any kind and simply clarify what the official language of the country is. And that's that. I mean, to the only law for language requirement is to require all government agencies to work in English, should that be the official law of the land. Everyone else, speak what you choose, where you choose it, though I would encourage someone to not operate their business in a sort of bilingual or simply another country's language.
Now, John, what would you say to the argument that given the rapid influx of people from another nation who speak another language, that this other language is rapidly becoming a secondary cultural language within this country? And as such, it is not wrong for people to offer services in that language, or even to require people at times to offer services in that language, because in certain Hispanic population, Spanish-speaking population already outnumbers the English-speaking population by a certain amount.
First of all, there's going to have to be some services that do offer, you know, their services in other languages. But to require them to do so is a violation of their freedom. Let's look at this for a minute. A rapid influx of people coming into the country, they're speaking another language, some other people are starting to speak the language. Okay, fine. Don't enact any law. All right? You know, we've got my system. We've stripped away all these language requirement laws, and we've only got one law. Government agencies, you know, government officials must speak the law of the land. And then you have a simple government edict. This is the law of the land. So, this is the language of the land. So, you basically now, fine. You put a nationwide referendum. You know, you take a proposal that Spanish should be added to the list of official languages of the United States of America. You slap it on there. put in the next four-year cycle ballot and let the people vote.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Give it a, and just to be sure, because it's that important, a huge cultural thing, give it a two-thirds majority.
Mm-hmm.
Require two-thirds majority for passage. And if more than two-thirds of the American people say, yeah, let's just add Spanish, then go add Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else needs to change then. You don't need to start enacting all these different laws. In this case, they need to speak this. In this case, they need to speak that. No, because then you have a situation where you have the same one law. All government officials and personnel have to speak the law, speak the language of the land.
Yeah.
Which is then Spanish and English.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the language of the land defined. It's that simple. And you could add everything from Japanese and Mandarin Chinese to Swahili, and that would still be the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no end to the number of languages you could add. I myself, I would prefer they just kept it at one or two.
Yeah. yeah.
But there's no limit then. You just add as many as you want and make every single postal worker a linguistic expert. You know, and problem solved. Democratically, even.
Well, perhaps we could do it by region.
By region?
Well, the thing is,
last time I checked, we didn't have a regional level of government. We had a state level, we had a federal level, and we had a local level.
Shut up, John.
No, I'm saying you would have to create a fourth level of government to legislate.
When I say region, I mean not at the top level. I mean at various lower levels. We can do the federal
but
level.
But I'm saying, if you're going
level.
To create laws that group together certain states, you would either have to...
No.
Certain states. You're missing my point altogether. Let me go back to, say, Switzerland. We were talking about Switzerland earlier. Each canton has its official language, because
mm-hmm.
each various cantons in Switzerland speak various languages.
Mm-hmm.
As such, in the United States, certain states and certain towns and certain counties have certain majorities of languages. It's not important that people in Maine learn to speak Spanish. But it might be important that people in, say, Texas or New Mexico learn to speak Spanish. So what if Texas and New Mexico added Spanish to their list of official languages and left Maine out of it?
Well, it would. That would work. Of course, you would have to create a mimicking law process for each individual state. And started defining its own language. There are several jurisdiction problems with that plan. Several significant jurisdiction problems. You know, who gets to decide the official language of the land? It seems to me, from the way things work right now, that would be a job of the federal government. Lamentable, to be sure, but I do think that all the eggs are in one basket as far as that goes. the past 190 years, you know, that's just what you'd have to deal with. So I don't know, but I do think that could work, but I don't think it would work. Just primarily because the state of California and the state of Texas do not have the right to dictate what the language of the land is. It seems to be a centralized problem.
Of course, it is the state of California and the state of Texas that are passing all these laws, which require certain languages to be spoken.
Yeah.
So it would seem that they do have de facto right to determine the law of the land, or the law of the land.
Of the state, anyway.
Oh, yeah, of the state.
See, but what if... All right, then I give you an extreme example. Tomorrow, the state of Iowa decides that its official language is Japanese and excludes English as... an official language. Okay.
And the people of Iowa have chosen this.
Yes.
Okay.
We're going to assume that, the people of Iowa had one of their world-famous caucuses and just decided Japanese is where it's at.
All right.
Cool. So now we have a group of Midwestern farmers in a land flat as a pancake speaking Japanese and not speaking English.
Hi.
But the federal government has its own law, according to my little system here, that says the law of the land is English.
Yeah.
So, who gets precedent?
Well, you might argue that while the states can add languages to the region, any language added by the federal government can't be removed.
So they would have to have a both and, not an either or.
Yes.
That might actually fly in the courts.
Yeah. But what would wind up happening is anything, any business that had to be conducted federally, you would be required to know English to go through with it. So people would effectively have to know English any time they dealt with the federal government, and because everyone has to pay things like income tax, everyone would have to have at least some way of getting a translation of the English documents, and then signing it over. And then on the state level, everything is required to be done in Japanese. So that would be the way it would wind up working. Although the idea of a senator from Iowa speaking with an accent tinged with learning Japanese his whole life is rather amusing.
You know, so I don't know. It could work. It could. I don't think it would be let fly just because of the way that preemption tends to work in the legal system today. Usually you don't see the court striving all that hard to make sure state law and federal law live in that much harmony. If there's a discrepancy between the two, they usually just strike down the state law and go with that.
Yeah.
Right.
This is very true.
But because preemption works that way, and preemption is defined as the preeminence of the federal law when it is impossible to both obey the federal law and the state law together, I do believe that that would be good enough cause to have the courts, probably English-speaking, if you really think about it, say, I'm sorry, but this Japanese thing is just absolutely ridiculous, and we're preempting the law.
Yeah.
All right, but in that, there we have another problem, which we should probably get to another time. We've been at this for a good hour now. Hour and some. Yeah, no, time flies. But yeah, we'll take on judicial supremacy another time.
All those for little things.
Yes.
We got to save that one for when your dad's on the program.
Yes, indeed. Indeed so. We need to get him on here sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Right.
So, all righty then. Well, it's been an excellent evening, and thank you all for listening, and thank you, John and Andrew, for the conversation. So, signing off for this evening, I'm Sean Vieira.
And I'm Sean Connolly. Oh, yep. See. All right, you get the gist.
Yeah, exactly. Aye, aye. All righty.
Okay.
Good night.
Arrivederci. Ciao.